From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, the gospel of science is what's happening. As we predicted, President Donald Trump has been acquitted in his Senate impeachment trial, saved by fellow Republicans who rallied to protect him 9 months before he asked voters in a deeply divided America right now to give him a second White House term. The businessman turned politician survived only the third presidential impeachment trial in U.S. history. And just like the other two, other impeached presidents in his turbulent presidency's darkest chapter, the president was acquitted largely along party lines on two articles of impeachment approved by the Democratic-led House of Representatives back in December, with the votes falling far short of the two-thirds majority required in the 100-seat Senate to remove him under the U.S. Constitution. Now, the Senate voted 52-48 to acquit him of abuse of power stemming from his request that Ukraine investigate political rival Joe Biden, a contender for the Democratic nomination to face the president in the November 3rd election this year. Republican Senator Mitt Romney joined the Democrats in voting to convict on one of the charges. No Democrat voted to acquit at all. Dr. Jerome Corsi on with us, author of a number of books, including The Late Great USA. Jerry, as we predicted, of course, he got acquitted. It was foolish for him to do what he did and maybe inappropriate, but not impeachable. Go ahead.
Well, I think, George, that's the key point, is that to impeach a president is really a political process. It takes two-thirds of the vote of the Senate, of those present, to remove a president from office. Impeachment just bringing the case to trial in the Senate, not removal from office. And the country is not in favor of removing President Trump from office. The Democrats don't have a political groundswell, and they did not take the time to build a case. I remember in Watergate, there were months and months taken, and you know, it was a well-developed case that Peter Rodrino was developing in the House in order to bring impeachment against President Nixon that caused him to resign. And we didn't see a similar process this time develop in the House of Representatives with Adam Schiff and with Jerry Nadler. It just didn't develop.
Jerry, I also want to get your take on yesterday's State of the Union address, where the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, seemed to want to shake the president's hand when he walked in. Honestly, I'm not sure if he saw that or not. By the angle I saw, I wasn't quite sure if he snubbed her or if he just didn't see that. But then at the end of the speech, she tears up his speeches on camera. That was a little tacky, too.
It was really kind of juvenile. I mean, that was the official version of the speech. It really needed to be preserved. It was kind of an impulsive and juvenile move. I'm not sure President Trump really snubbed Nancy Pelosi when he came in and did not shake her hand. It looked to me like he didn't see her reach out his hand.
So he didn't even shake Vice President Pence's hand.
Right. I mean, I don't think that was an intentional snub. I think Nancy Pelosi may have misinterpreted that. If she did, I think she was being snubbed. At any rate, regardless, this is a very ceremonial speech. I mean, I've watched them back to when John Kennedy was president. I mean, I've been watching them since I was a child, and they're always very ceremonial. The entire Congress and the House of Representatives, and they're met with a certain amount of decorum. The opposition to the president usually does not stand and applaud. That's accepted. But for the speaker to rip up the speech, I've never seen anything like that. That was really beyond the pale.
Thanks, Jerry. Keep in touch. The Democratic presidential race has now shifted to New Hampshire, with the full field of 2020 contenders blanketing the state ahead of its Tuesday primary. But in Iowa, they're still counting. 97% of the votes are in now. It's almost a dead heat with Pete Buttigieg and also Bernie Sanders. It's almost a dead heat there. An airplane carrying 178 people who lived in Hubei province in China, the epicenter of the coronavirus outbreak, landed at an Air Force base in Northern California, and they are being quarantined there for at least 14 days as officials from the CDC evaluate them and determine if they have contracted the virus. The 12th U.S. person with a confirmed case of the Wuhan coronavirus is isolated at a home in Wisconsin now. according to public officials, too. The death toll worldwide, 564 people. Police in Illinois looking for two men who caused nearly $10,000 in damage after they entered a Walmart with a caution, "I have the coronavirus" sign, and started spraying a mystery substance all over the place. What is wrong with people? One of my favorite actors, Kirk Douglas, Spartacus star and the larger-than-life persona, has died today. He was 103 years old. He was the father of actor Michael Douglas, had a Hollywood family that included his sons, producers Joel and Peter, and grandson Cameron Douglas. Kirk Douglas, dead at the age of 103. As we reported yesterday, in another signal of a changing landscape for American retailers, Macy's has announced a massive restructuring that would involve shuttering 125 department stores, cutting 2,000 jobs, and closing three corporate offices. Once a mall staple, Macy's joins a growing list of brick-and-mortar retailers that have struggled in recent years with the rise of e-commerce giants and changing consumer tastes. Experts have said that there is a lot more pain to come for many stores once titans of the retail space. Chuck Coppice is with us, a registered investment advisor, consultant. Chuck, I gotta ask you, you know, Sears took the bite. E-commerce is clubbing all these people, aren't they?
Well, that's part of it. You know, last year Payless had closed 2,500 stores. That's the biggest in history. Last year was 9,300 stores, in fact. And brick-and-mortar's been suffering. You know, the year before was 6,000, so we see the trend here. I think there's three reasons, George, and that is the shopping malls we see have been overbuilt for almost 40 years in suburbia. That's an old model.
Good point.
And then you have the online retailing, but that's only about 10% of retailing. It gets a lot of blame last year and even less the year before. I think the biggest factor is the middle class is just too indebted and has flat wages, you know, for almost 20 years now. In fact, the only retail growth, George, has been in the dollar stores, 38,000 of them, since 2008. What does that tell you? I think this is the new normal that we're seeing.
I think so, too. But is there any way to reverse the trend? I don't think so.
No, it's kind of a demographic thing. You know, the millennials would rather spend money on travel and dining and other things and retailing, and that's not their big thing. So it's kind of like Harley Davidson, you know. It's in trouble because the baby boomers, George, you and I are just getting a little older.
Yeah, well, that's true. Spell out your website for everybody, Chuck. I get a lot of emails every time you're on.
Well, it's my name, chuckcoppes.com, and that's C-O-P-P-E-S. And, of course, they go there, sign up, drop your name and email, get my free newsletter, and talk about these things.
All right. We've got the link, too, on our Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. Thanks, Chuck. Up next, he's back, Seth Shostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. That should tell you everything about what we're going to talk about for a little bit here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you and our special guest, Seth Shostak, back, senior astronomer and institute fellow at the SETI Institute, that is Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It is in Mountain View, California. He has an undergraduate degree in physics from Princeton and a doctorate in astronomy from California Institute of Technology. And for much of his career, Seth has conducted radio astronomy research on galaxies and for a decade chaired the International Academy of Astronautics, SETI's permanent committee, and every week hosts the SETI Institute's one-hour science radio show, Big Picture Science. His books include Confessions of an Alien Hunter, Cosmic Company, Sharing the Universe, Life in the Universe, and here he is back on Coast to Coast, one of our favorites, Seth Shostak. Seth, welcome back.
Well, it's a pleasure, George.
I'm looking forward to this. It's a great time to have you back. What's new in the world of SETI?
Well, listen, there's always something happening. I mean, there's, of course, the technical improvements in the equipment, the broadening of the search beyond radio to, you know, looking for flashing lasers in the sky, and, you know, new planets that have been found and so forth and so on. Now, of course, the bottom line is, have we found the aliens? And I wish I could say we have, maybe by the end of the hour. But in any case, we haven't done that. But there are new ways of searching, and those go beyond looking for signals, in fact.
I wanted to ask you, Seth, with the death of Paul Allen, who was a major benefactor for SETI, what has happened? Because you're really not getting government funds anymore, are you?
We are not. We are not. And that's a really lamentable situation. I was down at the Fleet Science Center in San Diego last night, And the first question that came up was, you know, why is a private donor to SETI, Franklin Antonio, he's down in the San Diego area, why is he supporting this instead of the federal government? And, you know, there's no good answer to that. I think about it fairly frequently. This used to be a NASA program. NASA was interested in finding not just life on Mars and some of the other nearby worlds, but also looking for intelligent life, and that was killed in 1993, and it has not been resumed. And it's a very peculiar thing that the subject that interests most people isn't getting any government funding whatsoever.
For the benefit of our new listeners, Seth, safe to say you believe that there's extraterrestrial life, intelligent life out there in the universe. You do not believe they have visited us here yet. Is that correct?
That's correct, and provocative, undoubtedly, but that's correct.
I wonder if we can get you to change your mind one day.
Well, you can try.
We did. Remember that great debate we had with the late Stanton Friedman?
Stanton Friedman, that's been quite some time ago. Yes, I do.
Well, I got to tell you a story about that, too. He was my first radio interview when I was 21 years old back in Detroit. I saw a little article that he was speaking at a university at night, and I told my news director, I said, let's cover this. This is going to be great. He said, kid, I'm not doing UFOs. You got to do it on your own time. So I went out there, interviewed Stan. It was my first radio interview. Ironically, Seth, when I was with him in Columbus, Ohio, at my live stage show in May, he died on his way back to the airport in Toronto. I was his last interviewer. So God works in strange ways, huh?
I got to say, you know, I didn't realize. I knew that he had died in the Toronto, you know, in Pearson Airport there in Toronto, and I didn't realize that you had just interviewed him. I actually traveled across the Atlantic Ocean on the QE2, I guess it was. It was the last transatlantic crossing of the QE2.
Uh-huh.
He and I were both speakers on board that ship. So I spent some time with him.
I miss him. He was a great guy, and he was fun, and he was never, like when he debated you, he was classy about it.
Well, he was. He won the debate, too, at least on the basis of the people.
The poll. That's right. Absolutely. So what's the number one reason we think there might be someone or something out there?
Well, I think the number one reason is still the same as it was, and that is to say, as it was, say, 5-10 years ago, and that is the incredible abundance of places where there could be life and even intelligent life. You know, the latest estimates suggest that maybe 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 6 stars has a planet that could be like the Earth. In other words, a planet that's roughly the same size as the Earth, probably the same composition as the Earth, and approximately at the same distance from its star, or at least at a distance where, you know, things won't be too hot or too cold. So, and if 1 in 5 stars, that means there's close to 100 billion such planets that might be like the Earth in our galaxy, and keep in mind there are 2 trillion other visible galaxies. So with all that real estate, you got to be, you know, pretty self-assured to think that this is the only place, that life, or for that matter, intelligent life, is cooked up.
In 1961, Frank Drake came up with that Drake equation based on exactly what SETI's after now.
He did. Yes, he did. That's as we've discussed, I think, the second most famous equation in all of science. At least somebody has considered it that way. And the first one being E equals MC squared from Einstein. But number two, the Drake equation, which anybody who's unfamiliar with it should just grab an astronomy textbook off the shelves of the library or maybe off the shelves of their bookstore and check it out, and they'll find the Drake equation in there. It's just, it was intended as an agenda for a meeting, but it just tries to estimate how many societies are out there right now that are broadcasting signals that we might pick up.
We're talking with Seth Shostak from SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. We'll take calls with Seth next hour. Seth, what's going on in terms of technology to try to find life out there?
Well, there are, in fact, several lines of attack. To begin with, a lot of the search for radio signals, and that's the classic approach to SETI, maybe because radio was, you know, the first technology that was invented that could, in fact, find something at, you know, great distances, light years of distance. And now we have lasers, and lasers are another way you might be able to send your favorite messages from one star system to another. But we didn't know about lasers in 1960. Well, we did, but, you know, we hadn't developed that technology very, very far. Radio technology has been around for at least 100 years, at least in a practical sense. It's pretty effective. You can build a transmitter, you know, that will fit in your living room that would be powerful enough to send signals to star systems, actually, you know, not just to the next town over, not just to the city of Encino. You could send signals, you know, 100 light years away if you had a big enough antenna. So that has been the approach. And because computers keep getting faster and faster, our ability to look for radio signals that might betray some aliens has been getting better all the time. Meanwhile, there are a couple of groups that are working on designing instruments that could look for flashing lasers. And, you know, we've had that idea for a while, but it was always looking at one star system at a time, and that's pretty slow going. The newer systems might be able to look at big chunks of the sky, maybe the entire night sky, looking for these brief flashes of light that would tell you somebody's got a laser out there.
Well, absolutely. Now, what about the possibilities that we're going to get some kind of machinery out there, like on Mars or something? You know, we had a couple rovers that were plumbing along, but they really didn't find anything, did they?
Well, they have, you know, to begin with.
They're not equipped with it.
Well, they're running around the surface of Mars. Well, they don't run, actually. They're pretty slow.
They tool along.
This is a slow tool as well. And they kind of mosey around Mars. But, you know, most of them, in fact, really none of them is looking for life directly. They don't have instruments on these rovers looking for some sort of life. Now, mind you, if there's any life on Mars, I mean, there are people who think that there's some sort of advanced life on Mars, but, you know, if that's true, I'll buy them a good sandwich somewhere, because Mars doesn't have the kind of conditions today, or probably ever, that would allow really interesting life in the sense of something big enough to see. But there could be microbes, or could have been microbes. And so these rovers, including the ones that are about to be launched this year by NASA, the Mars 2020 mission, are looking for places where there might have been life in the past. I mean, looking for dead life may not sound very interesting, but, you know, the thing about dead life is it doesn't go away. Life might,
that's right,
you know, kind of disappear. If you only look for things that are alive now, you might not find them. But if you're willing to look for stuff that might have been alive, you know, billions of years ago, then maybe there's more evidence.
Seth, what do you think of the stories, though, that come out, like the Navy fighter jets off the USS Nimitz chasing these what they call tic-tac UFOs? It's truly incredible video. I'm sure you've seen it.
I have. And, you know, yeah, it's pretty mysterious. Now, you know, of course, as you pointed out, I'm a little bit skeptical that these are actually alien craft. You know, every day there are like 2,500, more than 2,000 flights across the Atlantic, okay? And, you know, some of those Navy jets were flying off the West Coast here, down around, I think, around San Diego. And some of them were flying down the East Coast, and the ones flying down the East Coast, as I recall the testimony of one of the pilots, you know, they were seeing things every day. Okay.
Yeah, constantly.
Well, that's a lot of sightings. And
yeah.
The thing is, those 2,500 transatlantic flights every day that are flying between the United States and Europe, you'd think they'd see some stuff, right? I mean, but they don't seem to. And a lot of this stuff was based on the imagery, the tic-tac videos and so forth, from this camera. It's called an advanced targeting forward-looking infrared camera, FLIR, FLIR camera. This is something, I think, that's been around for, I don't know, 20 years, something like that. And it's fit onto these military craft. And it has essentially an infrared camera, a heat camera, if you will, but also a low-light TV camera and some laser devices and so forth and so on. But all these videos were made with the same camera, and it kind of makes, and in fact, for that matter, the same jet. And it makes you kind of suspicious that the aliens are only visible to this particular camera on this particular jet. That suggests to me that this might be an instrumental problem.
What drives you, though, Seth? Think about that. We're going to come back in a moment. Seth Shostak from SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In April, it'll mark 60 years since SETI's first experiment. And we'll talk more, and then we'll take phone calls with you and Seth next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Seth Shostak. Seth, Frank Drake, the founder of SETI, is going to be 90 in May. Do you have a chance to talk to him anymore or any communication there?
Well, yes. Not as much as I would like, I got to tell you. He used to be in the office very regularly. I mean, well, of course, every day in my earlier days at the SETI. But he is he comes in maybe once every 2 weeks still. He really does. And as I've maybe said before, he's kind of my hero. He's, you know, he's one of the world's last nice guys, incredibly bright, and just a really, really good guy.
What does he think about life out there, even though he came up with that Drake equation about the probability? What does he really think?
Well, unless he's very good at being disingenuous, I think he's quite convinced they're out there. I don't think he has any doubt himself. And, you know, he's estimated that, I mean, this equation that he has, which is designed to kind of get a handle on, you know, how many societies really might be out there right now that are broadcasting, if you will, a competition for this show, I suppose. He figures there may be 10,000 in our galaxy, but, you know, he's the first to admit that that's simply his best guess. But that tells you right there, the fact that he has that number and that it's a big number, it tells you that he's very optimistic that there's something to be found.
Anniversary coming up in April, 60 years for SETI, huh?
That's correct. 60 years ago, the same Frank Drake used an antenna there in the hills of West Virginia, and he pointed at a couple of nearby stars hoping to pick up a signal. And that was the first modern SETI search. Yep.
You've gotten some blips, but nothing really definitive. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you get signals all the time, and this is something that people who watch what SETI does in the movies or on television, you know, there's kind of a misrepresentation there, because it's usually just, you know, nothing but silence, just static, and then, you know, suddenly you pick up a signal and whoever's listening, it becomes ecstatic, I guess you could say. But that's not really the way it is. To begin with, the computers are doing the listening, which wouldn't make for very dramatic, you know, movie footage. But we monitor so many different frequencies, so many different radio channels, if you will, that you pick up signals all the time. I mean, every few seconds, there's another signal. Okay, so the trick is to decide, well, wait a minute. I mean, picking up a signal is not so hard, obviously, but is this really ET, or is it just, you know, another satellite that's beaming stuff down to Earth? There are a lot of them up there now, thousands that are doing this, and there are about to be a lot more. So, you know, this constant interference is a problem. So, yeah, I mean, you don't get, I mean, you say you get blips, but we've never gotten a blip where we could go back within a minute and find it again.
And find it again, yeah.
And verify that it's really something that's coming from beyond the Earth.
Whenever they find Earth-like planets and other star clusters, do you kind of move in that direction with the telescopes?
Well, we used to. Certainly in the early days, the first, you know, planets around other stars, or at least around other normal stars, that was found in 1995 by a couple of Swiss astronomers. And, of course, we swung our antennas in the direction of those star system, or that star system, it was one, that they had found the planets on. And we did that for a couple of years. You know, there'd be another couple of planets found and another couple of planets found, and you begin to, you know, point the antenna at all these things. But what we know now, because thousands of planets have been discovered, well over 4,000. And,
wow.
I mean, you could look at them all. I mean, maybe that's not a bad idea. But the thing is that, as we said earlier here, maybe one in five stars has a planet that might be like the Earth. They're all over the place. So the thing to do is forget about looking at individual star systems. Just point at as many star systems as you can, knowing that, you know, most of them, you don't know whether they have planets or not. And if one in five has a planet that's sort of like the Earth, I mean, you know, even if you look at 10,000 of them, that's saying that maybe 2,000 of them have a planet like the Earth. Well, that's a good thing to do. So we don't look at the individual ones anymore.
But do you have to technically in order to pick up a signal, or is it much wider than that?
Well, technically, I mean, you need to point the antenna somewhere, right?
Right.
Because the antennas are only sensitive to signals that might be coming from a little tiny spot on the sky. It's been likened to, you know, looking at the sky through a soda straw, if anybody still has straws. And
everything's made out of paper now.
Well, it's okay, then a paper straw, it doesn't have to be plastic. But you're only looking at a tiny bit of the sky. So you have to decide where you're going to point. And it probably does pay to point your antennas in the directions of other stars. Although you could always argue that, well, the really advanced aliens aren't on a planet around a star anyhow. I mean, that could be too. But since you don't know, it's probably the safest thing to do is point in the direction of nearby stars. You don't want to point it in the directions of very far away stars because the signals will be weaker.
If you hear a UFO story, and it's a really dandy UFO story, and they talk about a star system, whether it's the Pleiades or Zeta Reticuli or somewhere out there, does SETI aim at that when they hear those kind of stories?
Well, generally speaking, not. Now, in the case of Zeta Reticuli, and I think that was the Betty and Barney Hill story.
That's right.
Yeah, we actually did look at that back in the 1990s, in fact. It was something called Project Phoenix. That was our observing program. And we did observe in that direction, and we didn't pick anything up. Now, as far as the Pleiades are concerned, I don't know, everybody's fascinated with the Pleiades, but the Pleiades, you know, if you're an amateur astronomer, you might look at the Pleiades. It's a fairly young cluster of stars. I mean, it's also known as the Seven Sisters, and with really good eyesight, you can see seven stars there. But if you have a pair of binoculars, you can do a lot better than that. You probably see 100 stars because there are a lot of them. But they're only, you know, I don't know what it is, 50 million years old. It's a pretty young cluster. And, you know, 50 million years might be a long time if you're waiting for the bus, but 50 million years is pretty short when it comes to spawning life on a planet and having it evolve to intelligent life. I mean, that took 4 billion years on Earth. So it's pretty unlikely that the Pleiades have any advanced societies.
Seth, who owns SETI to date? Who owns it? Does anybody own it?
If they do, they haven't made their claim to me. I don't think anybody owns it. It's, you know, SETI to begin with is just a generic acronym, George. It just refers to the kind of experiment there is. It's like saying, well, what's the difference between soda and Coca-Cola? Well, soda is a generic term for all sorts of sodas that have brand names. So SETI just means the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. There are two groups in the world that are doing it today, the SETI Institute, where I work, and also the University of California, Berkeley, and that's it. But,
well, who writes checks when checks have to be written?
Well, the checks are written by the donors, right, because there's no government funding. The Berkeley program is supported by a fellow by the name of Yuri Milner. He's
the Russian, right?
He's the Russian, yes, the Russian investor. And our program is supported by Franklin Antonio, who...
Huh, okay. So if there's a bill to be paid, they pay it, or do they...
That's right.
That's amazing.
You got it.
Okay. How much would the equipment be worth if you had to build the whole place right over, all over again?
Well, I can tell you what it costs to build it the first time.
Okay.
The Allen Telescope Array, which is our premier instrument, cost on the order of $30 or $40 million.
And that's what Paul Allen donated?
Yes. Pretty much.
Paul Allen being one of the co-founders of Microsoft.
That's right. And, you know, you could say, oh, well, $30 or $40 million is a lot of money. But, you know, for some people, it's not all that much money. And the other thing is, compared to, I don't know, like the Large Hadron Collider,
yeah,
it's still very, very cheap. The difference is the Large Hadron Collider can come up with a definitive answer, yes or no, about something. For example, the Higgs boson, and it actually found it. It could have come up and said, well, it doesn't exist. I mean, it could have given you a definitive answer. The problem with SETI, in terms of the funding, I think, is that you can't design an experiment that could prove that they're not out there. All you can do is hope that you find something.
What about Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk, both interested in space? Have they contributed? Could they contribute?
Well, of course they could. I hope they will, but... they haven't so far, no.
Do you have a fundraising department or anything like that?
We do. It's a pretty thin department because we can't afford to pay people too much. I mean, we can't afford to pay them too much, but we can't afford to pay too many of them either. So that it's kind of a circular situation. You know, you can't afford to have a big fundraising operation because you're not raising sufficient funds. So, you know, it's kind of eating your own tail.
We should do for you one night a SETI fundraiser on the air?
Well,
will you bring us some guests and your people, and we just do it?
Well, you won't get an objection from me.
Well, we'll talk about that.
Okay.
Now, there's also talk that governments one day may disclose the arrival of UFOs.
Right.
I still think that'll never happen from government, that they're not going to disclose. Even if they were landing on the White House lawn, they'll deny it. What do you think?
Well, to begin with, they don't seem very keen to land on the White House
lawn. No, they don't.
They did in The Day the Earth Stood Still. Michael Rennie was there to greet them.
Love that movie.
Yes, it was a good one. I was actually an advisor for the remake, which, you know, where they didn't land on the White House lawn. They landed in Central Park, which is probably a little more dangerous for them. I don't know. Yeah, no, they don't do that. But this idea of disclosure. I mean, you don't think that it's going to happen because you don't think that the government would ever give that information up. I don't think it's going to happen because I don't think they have any information that substantially bears on this. You know, most people in the UFO community, of course, disagree with me about that. But I think that it's hard for them to disclose something if there's nothing to disclose. But, of course, that kind of an argument doesn't go very far because people will say, well, of course you're going to think that. But, you know, I mean, maybe you don't want to believe what you want to believe. I mean, you can believe anything you want about the U.S. government, but, you know, you also have to believe that about other governments.
Do you believe, Seth, that if we were being visited, if, that you would be in the know that somebody somewhere in government or someplace would pull you aside and say, Seth, this is happening?
Well, I don't know why they'd tell me in particular, but I think everybody would be in the know, actually, because here's the thing about it. I mean, consider the following. You know, we have lots of satellites up there orbiting the Earth. We talked about them a little bit. And I think it's like 770 of them are looking down at the Earth, right? I mean, if you go on Google Earth, for example, you can see some of this high resolution.
Right, and about a million more to happen, I guess.
Well, so, you know, there are all these things looking at the Earth. Essentially, every acre of the Earth is looked at least once a day by these satellites. And you would think that if there really was something in our airspace, other than the thousands and thousands of flights every day, you would see something. And you don't. So you know, you can say, oh, well, you don't because they don't tell you. But, you know, with 770 satellites, and they're not all American satellites, and they're owned by countries all around the world. You know, I think that that's a pretty good suggestion that maybe there isn't anything untoward in our airspace.
It is amazing, though. It's just one of the greatest mysteries of mankind. Now, Edgar Mitchell, the Apollo 14 astronaut who we lost several years ago,
yes,
told me that he was a staunch believer that we were being visited. He said that he was told by government officials that we've been visited. He admitted that he never saw anything when he walked on the moon or anything like that, but he said he believes these individuals who have talked to him. Isn't that enough to say maybe it's happening?
Well, I mean, you can say maybe, but I don't think it's very good evidence. I've talked to Edgar Mitchell many times myself.
And I bet he told you the same thing.
He did. He did. And he was the first to admit, I mean, he was straight up about this. He said, look, I didn't see anything myself.
Right.
He said he heard this from others. But, you know, if you got secondhand information.
Would they be deceiving him?
I don't know that they'd be deceiving him. Maybe he misunderstood it, or maybe they were joking around. I mean, I have no idea. But that's just not, I mean, for a question as important as this one is, I don't think that secondhand evidence, even from an astronaut, really tells you too much.
Taking God out of the equation just for a moment, if we can, why I believe there's life out there is because we can't explain how we got here. Again, take God out of the equation. I mean, that's by simply saying God created us, that's one answer. But by taking that out, we don't know how we got here, do we?
Well, at some level, I think we do, George. But, you know, biologists, there are plenty of evolutionary biologists out there who spend their lives looking into the question of how did life get started on Earth and how did it go from the first cells, the first life that, you know, could successfully reproduce without, you know, disappearing. It could, you know, make copies of itself that were close enough that it was still viable. from that all the way through, you know, the whole existence of life. I mean, single-celled organisms for, well, the first 80% of the history of life, and then the Cambrian explosion and all that, and then trilobites, dinosaurs, and a lot of mammals, and then us. And that record is in the rocks. I mean, that, you know, most of it is in the rocks. It's very hard for the early forms of life because they were soft and, you know, there were no bones mm-hmm. or anything like that. But this story is very well studied by biologists. So you don't need to make some appeal to, if you will, supernatural action to explain this and how we arose. I mean, there are all these, you know, other hominids that have been found, their skulls and things like that. I mean, that the evidence is all over the place. So I don't think it's, you know, it's not a solved, totally solved story. Otherwise, a lot of paleontologists would be out of work.
Let's talk more, Seth, when we come back, and we'll take phone calls with you. Seth Shostak with us from the SETI Institute. He once told me about the primordial soup that's out there in the universe and that it's all the same. And I think that's another key ingredient.